It's all going to be timing, she thought. Sir Guy paused on the far side of the strut, watching her for a moment. Then he crouched down and started to make his way around the strut. His hand was wrapped around the wood, the sword in his right hand temporarily pressed against the strut. She ran forward and stabbed his hand with the dagger, pinning it to the strut. Then she swung around to the opposite side of the strut and kicked his feet off the central beam. Guy fell into space, dangling from his pinned hand. He clenched his teeth but didn't make a sound. Jesus, these guys were tough. Still clutching his sword, he tried to get back up on the beam, but by then she had swung back to her original position on the other side of the beam. His eyes met hers. He knew what she was going to do. "Rot in hell," he snarled. "You first," she said. She pulled her dagger free from the wood. Guy fell silently to the ground below, his body growing smaller. Halfway down, he struck a pole from which a banner hung. His body caught on the wrought iron point, and for a moment he hung there. Then the pole snapped, and he slammed onto a table, sending crockery flying. The guests jumped back. Guy lay among the broken crockery. He didn't move. Oliver was pointing up to Kate and shouting, "Kill him! Kill him!" The cry was taken up around the room. Archers ran for weapons. Oliver did not wait. In a fury, he stomped out of the hall, taking several soldiers with him. She heard maids in waiting, young children, everyone chanting, "Kill him!" And she sprinted along the center beam, going for the wall at the far end of the great hall. Arrows whooshed past her, thunked into the wood. But they were too late. She could see that there was a second door in the other wall, matching the first, and she hit it hard, knocking it open, and crawled out of the hall into darkness. It was a very tight space. She banged her head against the ceiling, and she realized that this was the north end of the great hall, which meant it was freestanding and did not abut the castle wall. Therefore, she pushed upward at the roof. A section gave way. She stepped out onto the roof, and from there she climbed easily up onto the ramparts of the inner wall. From here she could see the siege was fully underway. Volleys of fiery arrows hissed overhead in smooth arcs, then descended to the courtyard below. Archers on the battlements returned the fire. Cannon on the battlements were being loaded with metal arrows, with Decare striding back and forth, barking instructions. Decare didn't notice her. She turned away, pressed her ear, and said, "Chris?" Decare spun. His hand clapped over his ear. Suddenly he was turning, looking everywhere along the length of the battlements and down into the courtyards. It was Decare. And then Decare saw her. He recognized her immediately. Kate ran. Chris said, "Kate, I'm down here." Flaming arrows were slashing down all over the courtyard. He waved to her up on the wall, but he was not sure she could see him in the darkness. She said, "It's..." But the rest was lost in static. By then he had turned away, watching Oliver and four soldiers cross the courtyard and go into a square building that he assumed was the arsenal. Chris at once began to follow when a flaming ball landed at his feet, bounced, and rolled to a stop. Through the flames he could see that it was a human head, eyes open, lips drawn back. The flesh burned, the fat popping. A passing soldier kicked it away like a soccer ball. One of the arrows raining down on the courtyard brushed past his shoulder and left behind a streak of flame on his sleeve. He could smell the pitch and feel the heat on his arm and face. Chris threw himself onto the ground, lying on his face, but the fire did not go out. It seemed to be smoldering. The heat became worse. He got to his knees and, using his dagger, cut his doublet open. He shrugged out of the burning coat and threw it aside. The back of his hand was still aflame from tiny drops of pitch. He rubbed his hand in the dust of the courtyard. The fire, at last, went out. Standing again, he said, "Andre, I'm coming." But there was no answer. Alarmed, he jumped to his feet just in time to see Oliver emerge from the arsenal, leading the professor and Merrick away, heading to a far door in the castle wall. The soldiers pushed them forward at sword point. Chris didn't like the look of it. He had the uneasy sense that Oliver was going to kill them. "Kate?"
"Yes, Chris?"
"I see them."
"Where?"
"Going into that corner door." He started to follow, realized he needed a weapon. Just a few feet away, a burning arrow struck a soldier in the back, knocking him face down on the ground. Chris bent over, took the man's sword, then stood again and turned to go.
Chris.
The voice was soft.
Over here.
Through the flames, he saw a dark figure standing motionless as a statue, staring at him across the courtyard. This dark figure ignored the fighting that swirled around him. He just stared fixedly at Chris. It was Robert Decaire.
Chris, do you know what I want?
Decaire said. Chris didn't answer him. Nervously, he hefted the sword in his hand, feeling the weight. Decaire just watched him. He chuckled softly.
Are you going to fight me, Chris?
And then Decaire started walking toward him. Chris took a breath, not certain whether to stay or run. And suddenly a door behind the great hall burst open, and a knight came out in full armor except for his helmet, bellowing,
For God and the Archpriest Arnaud!
He recognized the handsome knight, Raimondo. Dozens of soldiers in green and black were pouring out into the courtyard, engaging Oliver's troops in a pitched battle. Decaire was still stalking him, but now he paused, uncertain about this new development. Suddenly, Arnaud grabbed Chris by the throat, holding his sword high. Arnaud pulled him close, shouting,
Oliver! Where is Oliver?
Chris pointed to the far door.
Show me!
He went with Arnaud across the courtyard through the door. Following stairs spiraling downward, they came to a series of underground chambers. They were large and gloomy with high, curved ceilings. Arnaud pushed ahead, panting, red-faced with fury. Chris hurried to keep up with him. They passed through a second chamber, empty like the first. But now Chris heard voices up ahead. One of them sounded like the professor.
0 hours, 36 minutes, 2 seconds. On the control room monitors, the computer-generated undulating field had begun to show spikes. Biting her lip, Kramer watched the spikes grow higher and wider. She drummed her fingers on the table. Finally, she said,
Okay, let's fill the tanks. Let's at least see how they do.
Good,
Gordon said, looking relieved. He picked up the radio, began to give orders to the technicians down in the transit room. On the video monitor, Stern watched as heavy hoses were dragged over to the first of the empty shield tanks. Men climbed up ladders and adjusted the nozzles.
I think this is best, Gordon said. At least we'll...
Stern jumped to his feet.
No, he said. Don't do it.
What?
Don't fill the tanks.
Kramer stared at him.
Why? What can...
Don't do it,
Stern said. He was shouting in the small control room. On the screen, technicians were holding water nozzles above the fill aperture.
Tell them to stop! No water whatever in the tank, not a drop!
Gordon gave an order on the radio. The technicians looked up in surprise, but they stopped their work, lowered the hoses back to the floor.
David,
Gordon said gently,
I think we have to.
No,
Stern said.
We don't fill the tanks.
Why not?
Because it'll screw up the glue.
The glue?
Yes, he said. I know how to strengthen the tanks.
Kramer said,
You do?
How? Gordon turned to the technicians.
How much time?
35 minutes. He turned back to Stern.
There's just 35 minutes, David. There isn't time to do anything now.
Yes, there is, Stern said. There's still enough time if we go like hell.
0 hours, 33 minutes, 9 seconds. Kate came into the central courtyard of Laroque, to the place where she had last seen Chris, but Chris was gone.
Chris?
She heard no answer in her earpiece.
And he had the ceramic, she thought.
All around her in the courtyard lay burning bodies. She ran from one to the next, looking to see if one of them was Chris. She saw Raimondo, who gave her a little nod and a wave, and then he shuddered. For a moment, she thought it was the heat waves from the flames, but then she saw Raimondo turn, bleeding from his side. There was a man standing behind him, hacking repeatedly with his sword, cutting Raimondo at the arm, shoulder, torso, leg. Every cut was deep enough to wound, but not to kill. Raimondo staggered backward, bleeding freely. The man advanced, still hacking. Raimondo fell to his knees. The man stood over Raimondo, cutting again and again.
Raimondo fell backward, and now the man was slashing Raimondo's face, cutting diagonally across lips and nose, sending bits of flesh flying. The attacker's face was hidden by flames, but she heard him say, "Bastard, bastard, bastard," with each blow. She realized he was speaking English, and then she knew who the man was. The attacker was Decare.
Chris followed Arnaud deeper into the dungeon. They heard voices echoing somewhere up ahead. Arnaud moved more cautiously now, staying closer to the walls. At last they could see into the next chamber, which was dominated by a large pit in the ground. Above the pit, a heavy metal cage hung from a chain. The professor was standing inside the bars, his face expressionless as the cage was lowered by two soldiers who turned a winch crank. Merrick had been pushed against the far wall, his hands tied. Two soldiers stood near him. Lord Oliver stood at the edge of the pit, smiling as the cage descended. He drank from a gold cup, wiped his chin.
"I made you my promise, Magister," he said, "and I will keep it."
To the soldiers at the winch he said,
"Slower, slower."
Staring at Oliver, Arnaud growled like an angry dog and drew his sword. He turned back to Chris and whispered, "I shall take Oliver. You may have the others." Chris thought, "The others?" There were four soldiers in the room. But he had no time to protest, for with a scream of fury, Arnaud was running forward, shouting,
"Oliver!"
Lord Oliver turned, still holding his goblet. With a sneer of disdain, he said,
"So the pig approaches."
He threw his cup aside and drew his sword. In a moment, the battle was joined. Chris was now running toward the soldiers at the winch, not quite sure what he would do. The soldiers beside Merrick had raised their swords. Oliver and Arnaud fought bitterly, swords clanging, cursing each other between blows. Everything was happening fast now. Merrick tripped one of the soldiers near him and stabbed him with a knife so small Chris couldn't see it. The other soldier turned back to face Merrick, and Merrick kicked him hard so that he staggered back against the winch, knocking the men away. Unattended, the winch began to clank down more rapidly. There was a ratchet mechanism of some kind, so it turned noisily, but it was clearly moving faster than before. Chris saw the professor's cage descend below ground level, disappearing into the pit. By then, Chris had reached the first of the soldiers, whose back was to him. The man started to turn, and Chris swung, badly wounding him. He swung again. The man fell. Now there were only two soldiers. Merrick, his wrists still tied, was backing away from one, ducking the hissing blade. The second soldier stood by the winch. He had his sword out and was ready to fight. Chris swung. The man parried easily. Then Merrick, backing in a circle, banged against the soldier, who turned momentarily. Merrick shouted, "Now!" And Chris stabbed with the sword. The man collapsed. The winch was still turning. Chris grabbed it, then jumped away as the fourth soldier's sword came down with a clang. The cage sank lower. Chris backed away. Merrick was holding his bound wrists out to Chris, but Chris was not sure he could control the sword. Merrick was shouting, "Do it!" So Chris swung. The rope snapped. And then the fourth soldier was on him. The soldier fought with the fury of a man trapped. Chris was cut on the forearm as he backed away. He realized he was in trouble when suddenly his attacker looked down in horror, the bloody point of a sword protruding from his abdomen. The soldier toppled, and Chris saw Merrick holding the blade. Chris ran for the winch. He grabbed the crank and managed to stop the descent. Now he could see that the cage was deep in the oily water. The professor's head was barely above the surface. Another turn of the crank and he would have been submerged. Merrick came over, and together they began to crank the cage back up. Chris said, "How much time is left?" Merrick looked at his counter. 26 minutes. Meanwhile, Arnaud and Oliver fought on. They were now in a dark corner of the dungeon, but Chris could see the sparks from their clashing swords. The cage rose dripping into the air. The professor smiled at Chris. "I thought you'd be in time," he said. The black bars of the cage were slippery in Chris's hands as he swung the cage overhead away from the pit. Slime and black water dripped onto the dirt floor of the dungeon, leaving little pools. Chris went back to the winch. He and Merrick cranked the cage down, lowering it to the floor.
The professor was soaked, but he seemed relieved to be on solid ground again. Chris went back to open the cage, but he saw that it was locked. There was a heavy iron padlock, the size of a man's fist.
"Where's the key?" Chris said, turning to Merrick.
"I don't know," Merrick said. "I was on the ground when they put him in. I didn't see what happened when they put him in."
"Professor?"
Johnston shook his head. "I'm not sure. I was looking there." He nodded toward the pit. Merrick clanged his sword against the lock. Sparks flew, but the padlock was solid. The sword only scratched it.
"That's never going to work," Chris said.
"We need the damn key, Andre." Andre turned and looked around the dungeon. Chris said,
"How much time is left?"
25 minutes. Shaking his head, Chris went to the nearest dead soldier and began searching the body. Zero hours, 21 minutes, 52 seconds. In the control room, Stern watched as the technicians dipped the pale rubber membrane into a bucket of adhesive and then placed it, still dripping, inside the mouth of the glass shield. Then they attached a compressed air hose and the rubber began to expand. For a moment, it was possible to see that it was a weather balloon, but then it expanded still further, the rubber spreading and thinning, becoming translucent, assuming the curving shape of the glass shield until it had reached every corner of the container. Then technicians capped it, clicked a stopwatch, and waited while the adhesive hardened. Stern said,
"How much time?"
21 minutes to go.
He pointed to the balloons.
"It's homely, but it works."
Stern shook his head. "It was staring me in the face for the last hour."
"What was?"
"Blowouts," he said. "I kept thinking, what are we trying to avoid here? And the answer is blowouts, just like a car when the tires blow out. I kept thinking of car blowouts, and it seemed odd because blowouts are so rare now. New cars hardly ever have them because the new tires have an inner membrane that's self-sealing." He sighed. "I kept wondering why this rare thing was on my mind, and then I realized that was the whole point. There was a way to make a membrane here, too."
"This is not self-sealing," Kramer said.
"No," Gordon said, "but it'll add thickness to the glass and spread the stress."
"Right," Stern said.
The technicians had put balloons in all the tanks and capped them. Now they were waiting for the glue to harden. Gordon glanced at his watch.
3 more minutes.
"And then how long for each tank?"
6 minutes. "But we can do 2 tanks at a time."
Kramer sighed. 18 minutes. Cutting it close.
"We'll make it," Gordon said. "We can always pump the water faster."
"Won't that stress the tanks more?"
"Yes, but we can do it if we have to."
Kramer looked back at the monitor, where the field was undulating. But the peaks were clearer now. She said, "Why are the field bucks changing?"
"They're not,"
Gordon said, without looking back. "Yes," she said, "they are. The spikes are getting smaller."
"Smaller?"
Gordon came over to look. He frowned as he stared at the screen. There were 4 peaks, then 3, then 2, then 4 again, briefly.
"Remember, what you're seeing is really a probability function," he said. "Field amplitudes reflect the probability that the event will take place."
"In English?"
Gordon stared at the screen.
"Something must have gone wrong back there. And whatever it is, it's changed the probability that they will return."
0 hours, 15 minutes, 2 seconds. Chris was sweating. He grunted as he flopped the soldier's inert body onto its back and resumed his search. He'd spent frantic minutes going through the maroon and gray uniforms of the 2 dead soldiers trying to find the key. The surcoats were long, and underneath that, the soldiers wore quilted shirts, all in all a lot of cloth. Not that the key could be easily concealed. Chris knew that the cage padlock would require a key several inches long and made of iron. But Chris didn't find it. Not on the first soldier and not on the second. Swearing, he got to his feet. Across the dungeon, Arnaud was still fighting with Oliver. The clang of their swords continued ceaselessly, a steady metallic rhythm. Merrick was walking along the walls, holding a torch, searching the dark corners of the dungeon, but he didn't seem to be having success either. Chris could almost hear the clock ticking in his head. He looked around, wondering where a key could be hidden. Unfortunately, he realized, it could be almost anywhere. hanging on a wall or tucked into the base of a torch holder. He went over to the winch, looking around the mechanism, and there he found it, a large iron key at the foot of the winch.
Got it!
Merrick looked up, glanced at his wrist counter as Chris hurried over to the cage to insert the key. The key went right in, but it wouldn't turn. At first he thought the mechanism was stuck, but after 30 agonizing seconds of effort, he was forced to conclude that this was not the key after all. Feeling helpless and angry, he flung the key to the ground. He turned to the professor, locked behind the bars.
"I'm sorry," Chris said. "I'm really sorry."
As always, the professor was unruffled. "I've been thinking, Chris," he said, "about exactly what happened."
"Uh-huh."
"And I think Oliver had it," the professor said. "He locked me in himself. I think he kept the key."
"Oliver?"
Across the room, Oliver still continued to fight, although he was now obviously losing. Arnaud was a better swordsman, and Oliver was drunk and winded. Smiling grimly, Arnaud drove Oliver back with measured blows to the edge of the pit. There, Oliver, gasping and sweating, leaned on the railing, too exhausted to continue further. Arnaud gently put the point of his sword to Oliver's neck.
"Mercy," Oliver said, panting. "I beg mercy."
But it was clear that he did not expect it. Arnaud slowly pressed harder with the sword. Oliver coughed.
"My lord Arnaud," Merrick said, stepping forward, "we need the key to the cage."
"Eh? Key? To the cage?"
Gasping, Oliver smiled.
"I know where it lies."
Arnaud jabbed with the sword.
"Tell us."
Oliver shook his head.
"Never."
"If you tell us," Arnaud said, "I shall spare your life."
At this, Oliver glanced up sharply.
"Certes?"
"I am no treacherous, two-faced Englishman," Arnaud said. "Give us the key, and I swear, as a true gentle of France, that I shall not kill you."
Panting, Oliver stared at Arnaud for several seconds. Finally, he stood once again and said,
"Very well."
He threw away his sword, reached under his robe, and brought out a heavy iron key. Merrick took it. Oliver turned back to Arnaud.
"So, I have done my part. Are you a man of your word?"
"Indeed," Arnaud said. "I shall not kill you."
He moved forward swiftly and clasped Oliver's knees.
"I shall bathe you."
And he flipped Oliver bodily over the rail into the pit. Oliver landed with a splash in the black water below. He came up sputtering. Cursing, he swam to the side of the pit and reached toward the rocks to get a handhold. But the rocks that lined the pit were dark with slime. Oliver's hand slipped off. He could get no purchase. He treaded water, slapped ineffectually at the surface. He looked up at Arnaud and swore. Arnaud said,
"Do you swim well?"
"Very well, you son of a French pig."
"Good,"
Arnaud said.
"Then your bath will take some time."
And he turned away from the pit. With a nod to Chris and Merrick, he said,
"I am in your debt. May God grant you mercy all your days."
And then he ran quickly away to rejoin the battle. They heard his footsteps fading. Merrick unlocked the padlock, and the cage door creaked open. The professor stepped out. He said,
"Time?"
11 minutes, Merrick said. They hurried out of the dungeon. Merrick was hobbling, but he managed to move quickly. Behind them, they heard Oliver splashing in the water.
"Oh, no!"
Oliver cried, his voice echoing from the dark stone walls.
"Ah, no!"
Zero hours, 9 minutes, 4 seconds. The big screens at the far end of the control room showed the technicians filling the shields with water. The shields were holding up fine, but nobody in the control room was looking at the shields. Instead, they stared silently at the console monitor, watching the undulations of the shimmering computer-generated field. During the last 10 minutes, the peaks had become steadily lower, until now they had nearly vanished. When they appeared at all, they were just occasional ripples in the surface. Still, they watched. For a moment, the ripples seemed to grow stronger, more definite.
"Is something happening?"
Kramer said hopefully. Gordon shook his head.
"I don't think so. I think that's just random fluctuations."
"I thought it might be getting stronger," Kramer said.
But Stern could see it wasn't true. Gordon was right. The change was just random. The ripples on the screen remained intermittent, unstable.
Whatever the problem is back there, Gordon said, they still have it.
0 hours, 5 minutes, 30 seconds. Through the flames that leapt up in the central courtyard of Laroque, Kate saw the professor and the others come out of a far doorway. She ran to join them. They all seemed to be okay. The professor nodded to her. They were all moving fast. Kate said to Chris,
Do you have the ceramic?
Yes, I have it. He brought it out of his pocket, turned it to press the button. The professor said, There's not enough space.
There's space, Chris said.
No, you need 2 meters on all sides, remember? They were surrounded by fire. You won't find that anywhere in this courtyard, Merrick said. That's right, the professor said. We have to go out to the next courtyard. Kate looked ahead. The gatehouse leading to the outer courtyard was 40 yards away. But within the gatehouse, the portcullis was up. In fact, it didn't look as if the gate was guarded at all. The soldiers had all abandoned it to fight the intruders.
How much time?
5 minutes. Okay, the professor said. Let's get moving. They moved at a trot through the fiery courtyard, sidestepping flames and battling soldiers. The professor and Kate were in the lead. Merrick, wincing with the pain in his leg, followed behind, and Chris, worried about Merrick, brought up the rear. Kate reached the first gate. There were no guards at all. They ran through the gate, passing beneath the spikes of the raised portcullis. They entered the middle courtyard.
Oh, no,
Kate said. All of Oliver's soldiers were garrisoned in the middle court, and there seemed to be hundreds of knights and pages running back and forth, shouting to the men on the battlements, carrying weapons and provisions. No room here, the professor said. We'll have to go through the next gate, outside the castle.
Outside? Kate said. We'll never even get across this courtyard.
Merrick came hobbling up, panting. He took one look at the courtyard and said, Hoarding. Yes, the professor said, nodding. He pointed up at the surrounding courtyard. The hoarding. The hoarding was the enclosed wooden passageway built along the outside rim of the walls. It was a covered fighting platform, enabling soldiers to shoot down at attacking troops. They might be able to move along the hoarding and make their way to the far side of the courtyard and the far gatehouse. Merrick said, Where's Chris? They looked back into the central courtyard. They didn't see him anywhere. Chris had been following behind Merrick and thinking that perhaps he would have to carry Merrick, and he was wondering if he could do that, when suddenly he was shoved to one side, slammed bodily against a wall. He heard a voice behind him say in perfect English, Not you, pal. You stay here. And he felt the point of a sword jabbed in his back. He turned to see Robert Decaire standing in front of him holding his sword. Decaire grabbed him roughly by the collar, shoved him against another wall. Chris saw with alarm that they were just outside the arsenal. With the courtyard in flames, this was not the place to be. Decaire didn't seem to care. He smiled. In fact, he said, none of you bastards are going anywhere.
Why is that?
Chris said, keeping his eye on the sword.
Because you have their marker, pal.
No, I don't.
I can hear your transmissions, remember?
Decaire held out his hand.
Come on, give it to me.
He grabbed Chris again and shoved him through the door. Chris stumbled into the arsenal. It was empty now, the soldiers having fled. All around him were stacked bags of gunpowder. The basins where the soldiers had been grinding still lay on the floor.
Your fucking professor, Decaire said, seeing the bowls. Think you know so much? Give it to me.
Chris fumbled under his doublet, reaching for his pouch. Decaire snapped his fingers impatiently.
Come on, hurry up.
Just a minute,
Chris said.
You guys are all the same, Decaire said, just like Doniger. You know what Doniger said? Don't worry, Rob, we're making new technology that will fix you up. It's always new technology that will fix you up. But he didn't make any new technology. He never intended to. He was just lying, the way he always does. My fucking face.
He touched the scar that ran down the center.
It hurts all the time. Something about the bones, it fucking aches. And my insides are screwed up. Hurts.
Decaire held out his palm irritably.
Come on, you keep this up and I'll kill you now.
Chris felt his fingers close around the canister. How far away would the gas work? Not at the distance of a sword, but there was no alternative. Chris took a deep breath and sprayed the gas. Decare coughed, more irritated than surprised, and stepped forward.
You asshole, he said. You think that's a bright idea? Real tricky, tricky boy.
He poked at Chris with a sword, jabbing him backward. Chris backed up.
For that, I'm going to cut you open and let you watch your guts spill out. Fucking mess with me.
And he swung upward, but Chris dodged it easily, and he thought, it's had some effect. He sprayed again, closer to Decare's face, then ducked as the sword swung and struck the floor, knocking over one of the basins. Decare wobbled, but he was still on his feet. Chris sprayed a third time, and Decare somehow remained standing. He swung, the blade hissing. Chris dodged it, but the blade sliced his arm above the right elbow. Blood dripped from the wound, spattering on the floor. The canister fell from his hand. Decare grinned.
Tricks don't work here, he said. This is the real thing. Real sword. Watch it happen, pal.
He was prepared to swing again. He was still unsteady, but growing stronger quickly. Chris ducked as the blade whined over his head and slashed into the stacked bags of powder. The air was filled with gray particles. Chris stepped back again and this time felt his foot against a basin on the floor. He started to kick it aside, then noticed its weight beneath his foot. It wasn't one of the powder basins. It was a heavy paste, and it had a harsh smell. He recognized it immediately. It was the smell of quicklime, which meant the basin at his feet was filled with automatic fire. Quickly, Chris bent over and lifted the basin in his hands. Decare paused.
He knew what it was.
Chris took the moment of hesitation and threw the basin directly at Decare's face. It struck him in the chest, the brown paste spattering his face and arms and body. Decare snarled. Chris needed water. Where was there water? He looked around, desperate, but he already knew the answer. There was no water in this room. He was backed into a corner now. Decare smiled.
No water, he said. Too bad, tricky boy.
He held his sword horizontally, in front of him, and moved forward. Chris felt the stone against his back and knew that he was finished. At least the others might get away. He watched Decare approach. Slowly, confidently, he could smell Decare's breath. He was close enough to spit on him.
Spit on him?
In the instant that he thought it, Chris spat on Decare, not in the face, but in the chest. Decare snorted, disgusted. The kid couldn't even spit. Wherever spittle touched the paste, it began to smoke and sputter. Decare looked down, horrified. Chris spat again and again. The hissing was louder. There were the first sparks. In a moment, Decare would burst into flames. Frantic, Decare brushed at the paste with his fingers, but only spread it. Now it was sizzling and crackling on his fingertips from the moisture of his skin.
Watch it happen, pal, Chris said.
He ran for the door. Behind him he heard a whoomp as Decare burst into flame. Chris glanced back to see the knight's entire upper body was engulfed in fire. Decare was staring at him through the flames. Then Chris ran. As hard and as fast as he could, he ran. Away from the arsenal. At the middle gate, the others saw him running toward them. He was waving his hands. They didn't understand why. They stood in the center of the gate waiting for him to catch up. He was shouting, "Go! Go!" and gesturing for them to move around the corner. Merrick looked back and saw flames begin to leap up through the windows of the arsenal.
"Move!"
he said, then pushed the others through the gate and into the next courtyard. Chris came running through the gate and Merrick grabbed his arm, pulling him to cover, just as the arsenal exploded. A great sphere of flame rose about the wall. The entire courtyard was bathed in fiery light. Soldiers and tents and horses were knocked flat by the shockwave. There was smoke and confusion everywhere.
"Forget the hoarding," the professor said. "Let's go."
And they ran straight across the courtyard. They could see the final gatehouse directly ahead. 0 hours, 2 minutes. 22 seconds. In the control room, there were screams and cheers. Kramer was jumping up and down. Gordon was pounding Stern on the back. The monitor was showing field fluctuations again, intense and powerful.
"They're coming home," Kramer yelled.
Stern looked at the video screens, which showed the tanks in the room below. The technicians had already filled several shields with water, and the shields were holding. The remaining tanks were still being filled, though the water level was nearing the top.
How much time? He said.
2:20.
How long to fill the tanks?
2:10.
Stern bit his lip.
We going to make it?
You bet your ass we are, Gordon said.
Stern turned back to the field fluctuations. They were growing stronger and clearer, the false colors shimmering on the spikes. The unstable mountain peak was now stable, protruding above the surface, taking form.
How many are coming back? He said.
But he already knew the answer, because the mountain peak was dividing into separate ridges.
3,
the technician said. Looks like 3 coming back. 0:01:44. The outermost gatehouse was closed, the heavy grill of the portcullis was down, and the drawbridge had been raised. 5 guards now lay sprawled on the ground, and Merrick was raising the portcullis just enough so they could pass beneath it. But the drawbridge was still.
How do we get it open? Chris said.
Merrick was looking at the chains, which ran into the gatehouse itself. Up there, he said, pointing above, there was a winch mechanism on the second floor.
You stay here, Merrick said. I'll do it.
Come right back, Kate said.
Don't worry, I will.
Hobbling up a spiral staircase, Merrick came into a small stone room, narrow and bare, and dominated by the iron winch that raised the drawbridge. Here he saw an elderly man, white-haired, shaking with fear as he held an iron bar in the links of the chain. This iron bar was keeping the drawbridge closed. Merrick shoved the old man aside and pulled the bar free. The chain rattled. The drawbridge began to lower. Merrick watched it go down. He looked at his wrist counter and was startled to see that it said, 0:01:19.
Andre!
He heard Chris in his earpiece.
Come on!
I'm on my way.
Merrick turned to go. Then he heard running feet and realized that there were soldiers on the roof of the guardhouse, coming down to see why the drawbridge was being lowered. If he left the room now, they would immediately stop the drawbridge from lowering any further. Merrick knew what this meant. He had to stay longer. On the ground below, Chris watched the drawbridge as it lowered, chains clanking. Through the opening, he could see dark sky and stars. Chris said,
Andre, come on!
They're soldiers.
So?
I have to guard the chain.
What do you mean?
Chris said. Merrick didn't answer. Chris heard a grunt and a scream of pain. Merrick was up there, fighting. Chris watched the drawbridge continue to descend. He looked at the professor, but the professor's face was expressionless. Standing by the staircase leading down from the roof, Merrick held his sword high. He killed the first soldier as he came out. He killed the second one, too, kicking the bodies as they fell, keeping the floor clear. The other soldiers on the stairs paused in confusion, and he heard muttering and consternation. The drawbridge chain still rattled. The drawbridge continued down.
Andre, come on!
Merrick glanced at his counter. It said, 0:01:04. Just a little more than a minute now. Looking out the window, he saw the others had not waited until the drawbridge was entirely down. They ran to the descending edge and jumped out onto the field beyond the castle. Now he could hardly see them in the darkness.
Andre!
It was Chris.
Andre!
Another soldier came down the stairs, and Merrick swung his sword, clanging against the metal, spitting sparks. The man hastily backed up again, shouting and pushing the others.
Andre, run for it, Chris said. You have time!
Merrick knew that was true. He could just make it. If he left now, the men couldn't raise the drawbridge before he had run across it and was out on the plain with the others. He knew they were out there waiting for him, his friends, waiting to go back. As he turned to go down the stairs, his glance fell on the old man, still cowering in the corner. Merrick wondered what it must be like to live your entire life in this world, to live and love, constantly on the edge, with disease and starvation and death. And killing, to be alive in this world.
Andre, are you coming?
There's no time, Merrick said.
Andre!
He looked out on the plain and saw successive flashes of light. They were calling the machines, getting ready to go. The machines were there. They were all standing on their platforms, cold vapor drifting from the bases, curling across the dark grass.
Kate said,
Andre, come on.
There was a short silence. Then, I'm not leaving, Merrick said. I'm staying here.
Andre, you're not thinking right.
Yes, I am, she said.
Are you serious?
Kate looked at the professor. He just nodded slowly. All his life, he's wanted this. Chris put the ceramic marker in the slot at his feet. Merrick watched from the window of the gatehouse. Hey, Andre. It was Chris. See you, Chris. Take care of yourself.
Andre.
It was Kate.
I don't know what to say.
Goodbye, Kate. Then he heard the professor say, Goodbye, Andre. Goodbye, Merrick said. Through his earpiece, he heard a recorded voice say, Stand still. Eyes open. Deep breath. Hold it. Now. On the plane, he saw a brilliant flash of blue light. Then there was another. And another. Diminishing in intensity. Until there was nothing more. Doniger strode back and forth across the darkened stage. In the auditorium, the three corporate executives sat silently, watching him. Sooner or later, he said, the artifice of entertainment, constant, ceaseless entertainment, will drive people to seek authenticity. Authenticity will be the buzzword of the 21st century. And what is authentic? Anything that is not controlled by corporations, anything that is not devised and structured to make a profit, anything that exists for its own sake, that assumes its own shape. And what is the most authentic of all? The past. The past is a world that already existed before Disney and Murdoch and British Telecom and Nissan and Sony and IBM and all the other shapers of the present. The past was here before they were. The past rose and fell without their intrusion and molding. The past is real. It's authentic. And this will make the past unbelievably attractive. Because the past is the only alternative to the corporate present. What will people do? They are already doing it. The fastest growing segment of travel today is cultural tourism. People who want to visit not other places but other times. People who want to immerse themselves in medieval walled cities, in vast Buddhist temples, Mayan pyramid cities, Egyptian necropolises. People who want to walk and be in the world of the past, the vanished world. And they don't want it to be fake. They don't want it to be made pretty or cleaned up. They want it to be authentic. Who will guarantee that authenticity? Who will become the brand name of the past? ITC. I am about to show you, he said, our plans for cultural tourism sites around the world. I will concentrate on one in France, but we have many others as well. In every case, we turn over the site to the government of that country. But we own the surrounding territory, which means we will own the hotels and restaurants and shops, the entire apparatus of tourism, to say nothing of the books and films and guides and costumes and toys and all the rest. Tourists will spend $10 admission to get into the site, but they'll spend $500 in living expenses outside it. All that will be controlled by us, he smiled. To make sure that it is executed tastefully, of course. A graph came up behind him. We estimate that each site will generate in excess of $2 billion a year, including merchandising. We estimate that total company revenues will exceed $100 billion annually by the second decade of the coming century. That is one reason for making your commitment to us. The other reason is more important. Under the guise of tourism, we are in effect building an intellectual brand name. Such brand names now exist for software, for example, but none exist for history. And yet history is the most powerful intellectual tool society possesses. Let us be clear. History is not a dispassionate record of dead events, nor is it a playground for scholars to indulge their trivial disputes.
The purpose of history is to explain the present, to say why the world around us is the way it is. History tells us what is important in our world and how it came to be. It tells us why the things we value are the things we should value, and it tells us what is to be ignored or discarded. That is true power, profound power, the power to define a whole society. The future lies in the past, in whoever controls the past. Such control has never before been possible. Now it is. We at ITC want to assist our clients in the shaping of the world in which we all live and work and consume. And in doing so, I believe we will have your full and wholehearted support.
There was no applause, just stunned silence. That was the way it always was. It took them a while to realize what he was saying.
"Thanks for your attention," Doniger said, and strode off the stage.
"This better be good," Doniger said. "I don't like to cut a session like that short."
"It's important," Gordon said.
They were walking down the corridor toward the machine room.
"They're back?"
"Yes. We got the shields working, and three of them are back."
"When?"
"About 15 minutes ago."
"And?"
"They've been through a lot. One of them is pretty badly injured and will need hospitalization. The other two are okay."
"So? What's the problem?"
They went through a door.
"They want to know," Gordon said, "why they weren't told ITC's plans."
"Because it's none of their business," Doniger said.
"They risked their lives.
They volunteered, but they..."
"Oh, fuck them,"
Doniger said. "What is all this sudden concern? Who cares? They're a bunch of historians. They're all going to be out of a job anyway, unless they work for me."
Gordon didn't answer. He was looking over Doniger's shoulder. Doniger slowly turned. Johnston was standing there, and the girl, who now had her hair hacked short, and one of the men. They were dirty, ragged, and covered in blood. They were standing by a video monitor which showed the auditorium. The executives were now leaving the auditorium, the stage empty, but they must have heard the speech, or at least part of it.
"Well," Doniger said, suddenly smiling, "I'm very glad you are back."
"So are we," Johnston said, but he didn't smile. No one spoke. They just stared at him.
"Oh, fuck you people," he said. He turned to Gordon. "Why did you bring me here? Because the historians are upset? This is the future, whether they like it or not. I don't have time for this shit. I have a company to run."
But Gordon was holding a small gas cylinder in his hand.
"There have been some discussions, Bob," he said. "We think someone more moderate should run the company now."
There was a hiss. Doniger smelled a sharp odor, like ether.
He awoke, hearing a loud humming and what sounded like the scream of rending metal.
He was inside the machine. He saw all of them staring at him from behind the shields. He knew not to step out, not once it had started. He said loudly, "This isn't going to work!" And then the violent flash of laser light blinded him. The flashes came quickly now. He saw the transit room rise up around him as he shrank. Then the hissing foam as he descended toward it. Then the final shriek in his ears, and he closed his eyes, waiting for the impact. Blackness. He heard the chirp of birds, and he opened his eyes. The first thing he did was look up at the sky. It was clear, so it wasn't Vesuvius. He was in a primeval forest with huge trees, so it wasn't Tokyo. The twittering of the birds was pleasant, the air warm. It wasn't Tunguska. Where the hell was he? The machine rested at a slight angle. The forest ground sloped downward to the left. He saw light between the tree trunks some distance away. He got out of the machine and walked down the slope. Somewhere in the distance, he heard the slow beat of a solitary drum. He came to a break in the trees and looked down over a fortified town. It was partially obscured by the smoke of many fires, but he recognized it at once. "Oh, hell," he thought, "it's just Kestelgar." What was the big deal, forcing him to come here? It was Gordon, of course, who was behind it. That bullshit line about how the academics were disappointed,
It was Gordon. That son of a bitch had been running the technology, and now he thought he could run the company as well. Gordon had sent him back, thinking he couldn't return. But Doniger could return, and he would. He wasn't worried, because he carried a ceramic with him at all times. He kept it in a slot in the heel of his shoe. He pulled the shoe off and looked at the slot. Yes, the white ceramic was there. But it was pushed deep in the slot, and it seemed to be stuck there. When he shook the shoe, it didn't drop out. He tried a twig, poking in the slot, but the twig bent. Next, he tried to pull the heel off the shoe, but he couldn't get enough leverage. The heel stayed on. What he needed was a metal tool of some kind, a wedge or a chisel. He could find one in the town, he felt sure. He put the shoe back on, stripped off his jacket and tie, and walked down the slope. Looking at the town, he noticed some odd details. He was just above the east gate in the town hall, but the gate was wide open, and there were no soldiers along the walls. That was odd. Whatever year this was, it was obviously a time of peace. There were those times between English invasions. But still, he'd have thought the gate would always be guarded. He looked at the fields and saw no one tending them. They seemed neglected, with large clumps of weeds. What the hell? He thought. He passed through the gate and walked into the town. He saw that the gate was unguarded because the soldier on guard lay dead on his back. Doniger leaned over to look at him. There were bright streaks of blood coming from around his eyes. He must have been struck on the head, he thought. He turned to the town itself. The smoke, he now saw, was issuing from little pots that had been placed everywhere, on the ground, on walls, or on fence posts. And the town seemed to be deserted, empty in the bright, sunny day. He walked to the market, but nobody was there. He heard the sound of monks chanting. They were coming toward him, and he heard the drum. He felt a chill. A dozen monks, all dressed in black, rounded the corner in a kind of procession, chanting. Half of them were stripped to the waist, lashing themselves with leather whips studded with bits of metal. Their shoulders and backs were bleeding freely. Flagellants. That was what they were. Flagellants. Doniger gave a low moan and backed away from the monks, who continued past him in stately fashion, ignoring him. He continued to step away farther and farther until his back touched something wooden. He turned and saw a wooden horse cart, but there was no horse. He saw bundles of cloth piled high on the cart. Then he saw a child's foot protrude from one of the bundles, a woman's arm from another. The buzzing of flies was very loud, a cloud of flies swarming over the bodies. Doniger began to shiver. The arm had odd blackish lumps on it. The Black Death. He knew now what year it was. It was 1348, the year the plague first struck Castelgar and killed a third of the population. And he knew how it spread, by the bites of fleas, by touch, and by air. Just breathing the air could kill you. He knew that it could kill swiftly, that people just fell over in the street. 1 minute you were perfectly fine, then the coughing began, the headache. An hour later you were dead. He had been very close to the soldier by the gate. He had been close to the man's face, very close. Doniger slumped down against a wall, feeling the numbness of terror creep over him. As he sat there, he began to cough. Epilogue. Rain slashed across the gray English landscape. The windshield wipers snicked back and forth. In the driver's seat, Edward Johnston leaned forward and squinted as he tried to see through the rain. Outside were low, dark green hills, demarcated by dark hedges, and everything blurred by the rain. The last farm had been a couple of miles back. Johnston said, "Elsie, are you sure this is the road?" "Absolutely," Elsie Kastner said, the map open on her lap. She traced the route with her finger. 4 miles beyond Cheatham Cross to Bishop's Vale, and 1 mile later, it should be up there, on the right. She pointed to a sloping hill with scattered oak trees. "I don't see anything," Chris said from the back seat. Kate said, "Is the air conditioner on? I'm hot." She was 7 months pregnant and always hot. "Yes, it's on," Johnston said.
"All the way?"
Chris patted her knee reassuringly. Johnston drove slowly, looking for a mileage marker at the side of the road. The rain diminished. They could see better. And then Elsie said, "There!" On the top of the hill was a dark rectangle, with crumbling walls.
"That's it?"
"That's Eltham Castle," she said. "What's left of it?" Johnston pulled the car over to the side of the road and cut the ignition. Elsie read from her guidebook. "First built on this site by John Delthame in the 11th century, with several later additions. Notably the ruined keep from the 12th century and a chapel in the English Gothic style from the 14th, unrelated to Eltham Castle in London, which is from a later period." The rain lessened, now just scattered drops in the wind. Johnston opened the car door and got out, shrugging on his raincoat. Elsie got out on the passenger side, her documents encased in plastic. Chris ran around the car to open the door for Kate and help her out. They climbed over a low stone wall and began climbing up toward the castle. The ruin was more substantial than it had seemed from the road, high stone walls dark with rain. There were no ceilings. The rooms were open to the sky. No one spoke as they walked through the ruins. They saw no signs, no antiquities markers, nothing at all to indicate what this place had been, or even its name. Finally, Kate said, "Where is it?"
"The chapel? Over there."
Walking around a high wall, they saw the chapel, surprisingly complete, its roof rebuilt at some time in the past. The windows were merely open arches in the stone, without glass. There was no door. Inside the chapel, the wind blew through cracks and windows. Rain dripped from the ceiling. Johnston took out a large flashlight and shone it on the walls. Chris said, "How did you find out about this place, Elsie?"
"In the documents, of course," she said. "In the Troyes archives, there was a reference to a wealthy English brigand named Andrew Deltham, who had paid a visit to the monastery of Saint-Mare in his later years. He brought his entire family from England, including his wife and grown sons. That started me searching."
"Here," Johnston said, shining his light on the floor. They all walked over to see. Broken tree branches and a layer of damp leaves covered the floor. Johnston was down on his hands and knees, brushing them away to expose weathered burial stones that had been set in the floor. Chris sucked in his breath when he saw the first one. It was a woman, dressed demurely in long robes, lying on her back. The carving was unmistakably the Lady Clare. Unlike many carvings, Clare was depicted with her eyes open, staring frankly at the viewer.
"Still beautiful," Kate said,
standing with her back arched, her hand pressed into her side. "Yes," Johnston said, "still beautiful." Now the second stone was cleared away. Lying next to Clare, they saw André Merrick. He, too, had his eyes open. Merrick looked older, and he had a crease on the side of his face that might have been from age or might have been a scar. Elsie said, "According to the documents, Andrew escorted Lady Clare back to England from France and then married her. He didn't care about the rumors that Clare had murdered her previous husband. By all accounts, he was deeply in love with his wife."
They had five sons and were inseparable all their lives.
"In his old age," Elsie said, "the old routier settled down to a quiet life and doted on his grandchildren. Andrew's dying words were, 'I have chosen a good life.' He was buried in the family chapel in Eltham in June 1382.
1382, Chris said. "He was 54.
Johnston was cleaning the rest of the stone. They saw Merrick's shield, a prancing English lion on a field of French lilies. Above the shield were words in French. Elsie said, "His family motto, echoing Richard Lionheart, appeared above the coat of arms. Mes campignons, qui j'aime et qui j'aime, me dit chanson." She paused. "Companions whom I loved and still do love, tell them my song." They stared at André for a long time. Johnston touched the stone contours of Merrick's face with his fingertips. "Well," he said finally, "at least we know what happened."
"Do you think he was happy?" Chris said.
"Yes," Johnston said, but he was thinking that however much Merrick loved it, it could never be his world, not really. He must have always felt a foreigner there, a person separated from his surroundings, because he had come from somewhere else. The wind whined. A few leaves blew, scraping across the floor. The air was damp.